From KERA in Dallas, Texas, this is a special edition of Think. I'm Chris Boyd. On this fourth day, after 14 people were shot and 5 killed in downtown Dallas, we are getting over the sense that it can't possibly be true. 25-year-old Micah Xavier Johnson targeted police officers present at a rally in protest of police killings of civilians in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and Falcon Heights, Minnesota, before he was killed by a robot-delivered explosive device operated by Dallas police. Johnson's bullets struck a total of 12 police officers and 2 civilians. The scale of the bloodshed is nightmarish on its own, but it comes laden with the burdens of racial hatred. Like many places in America, Dallas has a long history of racism. But over time, our community has also been home to people from many different backgrounds who are committed to speaking openly about the dangers of racial segregation, prejudice, and inequality, and also committed to minimizing the effects of these insidious threats to peace and security. Tomorrow, President Obama will fly to North Texas to join President George W. Bush for a memorial service to honor our fallen law enforcement officers. Both were invited by Dallas Mayor Mike Rawlings, who joins us for this first segment of the program. Mayor Rawlings, welcome back to Think.
Thanks so much for having me.
It's hard for me to imagine the kinds of conversations you've had to have in the past few days with families of the dead and wounded police officers. Is there anything you can say that brings them comfort?
Well, the one thing I did say, which is true, you always have to speak from authenticity, is that I cannot in any way understand the pain that those families are going through, the wives I've spoken to, the daughters, the fathers. And I can't understand the pain that officers are feeling of their friends that have died. Those are deep things. But when you add up all the pain that the city is feeling in a cumulative fashion, that somehow it starts to touch their pain, that they're not alone in this, that the community is deeply, deeply mourning, and it doesn't bring anybody back, but you don't feel alone in this process with that. And so that's what I said.
Can you give us even general information about the individuals who were wounded but survived their injuries?
I met with many of them, a couple of them. They were very, very brave. Many of them kind of said, you know, in the old phrase, 'tis only a flesh wound, and they jumped back in. I met with one man who had gotten his a bullet through his tricep, and he had was leaving the hospital. I met with one man who had been shot in the calf and the leg, and I saw blood still dried on his leg. And the pain that he felt was not the pain in that, but he was in a squadron where he lost 3 of his friends. And that, so the pain of those people shot is really the wounds of the soul that they're going through. Understanding why is this happening when I'm trying to help people, and understanding that, and hopefully that's what we're going to be thinking about as we go forward as a city.
Before we imagined that we would have any kind of connection directly, except as human beings who have empathy, what do you think when you turn on the television or go online and you see video of a shooting such as happened in Baton Rouge or in Falcon Heights, Minnesota?
Well, I'm in horror of it. Understanding that you don't get the whole picture, but the drama of it is heartbreaking. And you realize that out of the millions and millions of police interactions, a few happen that are devastating and take the lives of individuals that shouldn't be killed. And that's what we're dealing with here today. The question is, can we somehow bracket that? Can we compartmentalize that and put it in a bigger equation that says that 99% of the time our police are valiant, brave, and they're the underpinning of our society? And that's the sign of a more sophisticated mind and a more sophisticated media, to say that both of those things can happen at the same time.
I think it's important to say it over and over that it was a peaceful demonstration that one person marred with acts that are really incomprehensible for almost anybody. But before the worst happened on Thursday, were you or any other local leaders particularly concerned about what was going to happen in Belo Park?
I wasn't. Anytime I hear that there's a protest, I sit up and get a briefing and understand what's happening. But we've been through so many protests. We did our Occupy. We've done other racial protests. After Jefferson, we had issues. We had a protest in South Dallas amongst two groups that carried guns and facing each other off. And our police did a marvelous job to make sure that that was peaceful. So I put that in the context of our performance and felt safe about that, felt that the protesters were going to be safe, and our police knew how to do that. And, in fact, they did. It wasn't until a person filled with evil decided to ambush white police officers and dial this whole discussion up to the next level.
A number of participants or observers at that rally were openly carrying weapons, and you alluded to other demonstrations where that's happened. Presumably, all who had them on the ground were legally authorized to have them. You say, though, the choice of civilians to take weapons with them into the public complicates things for police officers.
Very much. One did not have the license, and that person was arrested later. But it does complicate it, especially in this case. You had a very sophisticated shooter that was shooting and moving, and you didn't know where the shots were being fired from. Meanwhile, you had individuals in body armor running down the street with their same rifle. And as a decision maker, as a police officer, you've got to decide who are the bad guys. And that takes your eye off the ball. In my belief, somehow we can have peaceful demonstrations without firearms.
You have called the use of an explosive-laden robot deployed against Micah Johnson a brilliant tactic. Let's listen here to Chief David Brown, Dallas Police Chief, at a press conference today addressing that decision.
He had already killed us in a grave way. And officers were in surgery that didn't make it. I didn't know they would pass, but I knew that at least two had been killed. And we knew through negotiation this was a suspect because he was asking us how many did he get. And he was telling us how many more he wanted to kill. This wasn't an ethical dilemma for me. I'd do it again, Keith. I'd do it again to save our officers' lives.
And what about to use the robot?
To use the robot? I would use any tool necessary to save our officers' lives. And I'm not ashamed to say it.
Do you think this is the first of many incidents in which police departments across the country utilize this kind of technology?
I don't know. That's for a police officer to decide. I love Chief Brown's phrase that this was an ethical dilemma for him, and it wasn't one for me as well.
Did he contact you before he made the call?
We talked briefly before, and then he told me that he had made that call. It was his decision, but I supported him completely. This man had a choice, okay? This wasn't a surprise attack. This was a choice to come out and save himself and to stop hurting our police officers. He threatened to blow everybody up, and we thought he had that capability, or to stay there and die. And so the question is how best to do that and save the lives of our police officers. So I'm pleased that in hindsight the Chief Brown is so strong in that, because I am too.
Even a typical presidential visit requires large allocations of resources to ensure security. Certainly President Obama and former President Bush have their own Secret Service details. Are you at all concerned about the ability to provide optimal security at the memorial service tomorrow for the dignitaries who will be present and any members of the public that will be there?
I'm not because of the support of our other police departments, Texas Department of Public Safety, and other federal officials. It was concerning, and you might give thought to it, that our police officers are exhausted and they can't do that by themselves and mourn. And we've got to remember mourning is a very important part of this whole life that we live as a city. So I'm pleased that everybody's jumped in. People have volunteered, and we're going to take them up on that. So we'll be safe. We will be safe. But it is a stretch in this community. But in some ways, we know that we are a laboratory, that the whole country, the whole world is looking at. We're going to have President Bush. We're going to have President Obama. We're going to have Senator Cornyn. We're going to have people from both sides of the aisle, hopefully coming together, holding hands, saying thank you to our officers, and more importantly, paint a different future for us.
Has Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick, who says that he blames the Black Lives Matter movement for what happened Thursday, has he been invited?
He wasn't. I haven't been contacted. He came on Friday. And was participated in the Thanksgiving Square event.
For people who don't know and love Dallas as you do, do you think what happened last week reinforces the perception outside the city that this is a city of hate?
I don't. What I've been fascinated by is everybody's pleasant surprise about Dallas. They haven't been here for so long, and they've understood how contemporary and how cosmopolitan, how progressive we are as a city. Anytime people die, it puts a black mark on a city. But the media that I'm reading, the reporters that I'm talking to, there seems to be a different spin on this, the randomness. But yet they've also focused on how good our police department has done over the years. We have the lowest amount of police-related shootings than any major city in the United States. So we got a chance in a strange way to brag a little bit about how Chief Brown taught everybody in de-escalation, about community policing, about really talking to all the organizations across the city. And people have kind of been pleasantly surprised about that. So there is some lemonade there someplace.
So what do you do with that unanswerable question that everyone has, which is why here?
Well, we're a big city, okay? That's the first. Size creates an opportunity for an individual to wreak havoc. Where there are people, I guess I can kill them. A second is that we have politically minded protesters that will come out and make a big make their statement about this, and that provided an environment for that. But you know, we had Ebola here. Okay, we had right up in Garland. You know, we had their instance. We're going to have this more and more. We've got a multinational airport that people fly into. And so there will be more incidences, hopefully, if not this level, in the future.
Dallas Mayor Mike Rawlings, thank you very much for making time for us.
Thank you, Chris.
Up next, we will speak with Michael Mata, who is vice president of the Dallas Police Association, in our special edition of Think Today, talking about coping with the Dallas police shootings from last week. If you would like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or find us on Twitter at KERAThink. From KERA in Dallas, Texas, this is a special broadcast of Think. I'm Chris Boyd. We're continuing our conversation about the response to Thursday's shooting attack on a peaceful demonstration against police violence in other cities. We turn now to Michael Mata, vice president of the Dallas Police Association. He's a 20-year veteran of the Dallas Police Department and is currently patrol sergeant at Northeast Division. Sergeant Mata, welcome to Think.
Thank you for having me.
First of all, I'm sorry for the loss of your colleagues. I share your concern for their families and as well as the officers and civilians who were shot but have survived. It must be a blow to anyone who has worked with these folks.
It's a huge blow. You know, although we all accept the fact that we have a dangerous job and we answer calls that are primarily violent or they wouldn't be calling us for the most part. And we accept the fact that we have the chance that we might die in the line of duty. And most of us have, you know, been okay with that since the day, hopefully since the day they walked through the academy and understood that. But what happened on that day in the middle of that street after that, what I thought was a very positive protest between the community and the police community itself, was a travesty and a shame.
This wasn't just any protest. The catalyst was police shootings of civilians in other cities, but there are concerns generally about the relationship in this country between police and particularly people of color. What can you tell us about how DPD trains its officers in the use of deadly force and in cross-cultural exchanges with members of the public?
Well, you know, I've been very lucky in my profession that I had the opportunity to teach at the Dallas Police Academy for 6.5 years. And before that and continue through that, I've taught multiculturalism for the department. And we have done this for a very long time. The City of Dallas and Dallas Police Department for an extended many of years have reached out to the community, have done everything possible, I think, to try and engage the community much more than some other cities possibly so that we could prevent any type of social unrest with communication prior to having some type of social unrest. And I think we've been very successful in doing that in late years. But the problem with, and I'm talking about the use of force, the problem with the use of force is we teach a force continuum. And a force continuum is levels of force that you are allowed to do once a suspect has done something or has displayed something. So everything we do is a reaction to what they do. So very few, if never, are we just going to jump out and do something. We have to see something first because that's just how our mind works. We will go through steps. So it's very hard to explain to the community that cooperation and compliance would solve so much of this because you cannot argue sometimes the arrest in the street. That's not the place to argue it. Most times we're arresting you because we either on viewed an offense or we have been given information by a credible witness of an offense. Or we have run you and you have a warrant for your arrest. And once those things happen, we do not have the ability to make a choice. Most of those laws say you shall or you will, not that you may. A long time ago, there was a lot of may and it gave officer discretion. But not anymore. There's a lot of shall. So those choices aren't there anymore. So we are almost forced by law to do what we have to do.
Do you think that police officers should have more discretion to decide not to use deadly force?
Well, and I don't think we have the discretion in deadly force. I'm talking about the idea of an arrest.
Mm-hmm.
The force continuum allows you discretion in what you see and how you judge that threat. And the difference is when you see a very small snippet of a video, you're not seeing what we call and what the court system calls the totality of the circumstances, the complete totality of the circumstances. And that starts from the moment you get the call sheet because there's so much information on that call sheet that prepares you for what you're getting involved in. The description of a suspect, violent acts that have occurred prior to you getting there, any other arrests that have happened at that location, if this person has a violent history, all that prepares yourself. But none of that is shown in a video.
Have you seen videos that, from where you sit, look, and we're not talking in these cases in the immediate past about incidents in Dallas, but have you seen videos that make you think the officer made the wrong call?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, one of my jobs as one of the executive board members of the Dallas Police Association, I'm head over legal. So I'm the liaison between the officer, our attorneys, and the department. When they are receiving discipline, I go in the hearings with them. And a lot of times at those hearings, more often than not, if it has anything to do with driving, use of force, or an incident that now we have so many body cameras, they'll show the video. And sometimes those videos don't look good. But what we need the public to understand is violence isn't supposed to look good. There's nothing pretty about violence. It is a form of intimidation. And any shooting is a horrible waste of life. But there is nothing pretty about a shooting either. So anytime you look at it, it looks horrible. But you're right. I have seen videos that I'm like, man, that doesn't look good. But what I do is I pause for a second and I allow the investigation to begin, go through its process, and get to the point of adjudication so you can see everything. Because you cannot look at a 10, 20 second video clip and say for sure that is a crime. Because if that's the case, a lot of citizens would be in jail for videos that happen all the time in surveillance.
All right, let's go to the phones now. We have Leonard on the line in Arlington. Hi, Leonard.
Yes, hi. Yeah, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Hi, Leonard. How are you doing?
I'm wondering what techniques are being put in place, specifically in the police department. I'd like to see this implemented citywide, things like nonviolent communications, conflict resolution techniques, so that in the future, perhaps people will be able to express their discontent and their conflict in ways that are not violent.
Well, that's a good question. And I want to tell you, we already have teach those, and we've been teaching them forever. It started years and years ago. A lot of officers out there, if they're listening, it was called a verbal judo years ago. We have had conflict resolution for the last at least 15 years. We have had situation de-escalation for the last 10 plus years. The problem is you have to have two parties have to be willing to have that conversation and be willing to de-escalate a situation. It doesn't work with just one person. I'm still a patrol supervisor. I go out to these calls every single day. Last night I answered 14 calls myself, responding as a supervisor and also just initiating self-activity. And the person you come in contact with has to want to have dialogue with you. If they don't want to have dialogue with you, then it's a one-way street of talking. And no matter what you say, you cannot convince somebody to put handcuffs on. Very rarely. A lot of times now we deal, unfortunately, with people who have serious mental issues, whether it's drug addiction or mental health issues. Police officers are not psychologists. We are not therapists. We get 8 to 16 hours of training every other year and some in the academy, but yet we go out and handle calls with people who are manic depressive, who have schizophrenia, who are bipolar, and we are not doctors. In most of those conditions, they do not like to be touched. But yet we are called there to do what? To take them to a medical facility. And to do that, we have to follow policy, and that is to place them in handcuffs and put them in back of a car. It's almost asinine that we have went down this road. But we have got a government that has failed the medical and mental health professions. We have a mental health profession that has failed their patients. And all of them have failed the police in this nation because you have put so much responsibility on somebody who is not a doctor. But yet we're making physician decisions. And so it's a no-win for us. And a lot of those situations are the ones that escalate into use of force and, unfortunately, into deadly force. But those things don't get put on a 20-second video. And that's what the community doesn't understand. And that's why nobody wants to be a cop anymore.
I know you're aware that there are many people of color in this community and others in the United States who feel like, regardless of what they've done or haven't done, mm-hmm. busted taillights. I'm talking about offenses that are not potentially violent, mm-hmm. That they're not going to get treated with the same respect that a middle-class white person can expect.
Okay, I'm not going to lie in any way, shape, or form, think that there is not racism in the police profession. We're humans. There's racism in doctors and lawyers and accountants and any high-rise downtown. There's racism on every single floor. The difference is they don't incarcerate people. Their lives and their job is not on 27 TV and on social media. Every time you turn around, it used to be when I was a young officer, If you had to fight somebody or you're wrestling somebody, citizens came to your aid. Did they come to my aid to help me, or did they come to my aid to prevent more violence from occurring? I didn't care. It was just good that they helped me, so it didn't escalate to a point. Whether to help me de-escalate it, to help me handcuff him, so it didn't get to a point of more violence. But what happens now? What happens now? You have citizens that are more engaged in getting that 10-second video to throw on Facebook, and they are hoping, they are wishing that it becomes a violent encounter so their video goes viral. And that we have a society problem here. You know, I think a lot of people will agree with me out there. Facebook is the devil. You know, it's got a lot of great stuff when you put your kids' stuff on it, but we are seeing more and more negativity on social media than positivity, and it's sad.
All right, let's go back to the phones now. This time we'll speak with Colleen in Roseville, Minnesota. Hi, Colleen.
Hi.
Hi, Colleen.
I would like to find out what your if anybody's giving any thought to the fact that this is really the 21st century civil rights movement.
Okay. You know, that's very broad. Civil rights movement. Are we talking judicial?
In the immediate days, yes, it's about the police and African Americans. But if we look at this overall, across what's happening across the United States in general, is this a 21st century civil rights movement? Because we live in a much more multicultural society, and people do not feel that they are all treated equally.
I'm sorry. What's your name? I apologize.
It's Colleen.
Colleen. I'm going to ask you this, and in no way am I being disrespectful or condescending. It's an honest answer. Have you ever rode out with a police officer?
No, most civilians have not, and I think
that might
be a thing that would expand our knowledge.
And that's what I'm trying to tell you. Every major city, if not every major city, has a ride-along program. We encourage the public to come right along with us, see what we go through, see the decisions we have to make. And I've probably over my career have probably had 50, 100 ride-alongs. And the attitude that they had or the discussions we had between our first call and our 20th call was amazingly different. But it was a great constructive conversation that we had in that car. So that's my problem. What we are judging a profession on is not any firsthand knowledge a lot of times. And don't get me wrong. There are a lot of Americans that have been treated poorly by the law enforcement community. I in no way am in denial that there are not bad shootings and that there are not bad cops. But I give you my word, I have trained, I have helped train at least 40 to 45% of the Dallas police officers today. And I promise you, we have done everything possible to get the bad apples out of the bucket. But when it comes to that multicultural class I teach, when I go in there and teach them, I tell them, there's nothing I'm going to teach in these 8 hours that is going to show me who the racist is. Because if you've made it this far, you're really good at hiding it. But you won't make it 5 years in this career because you cannot do it in the public.
Sergeant Mata, on Thursday night, we had a nightmare come true. Over the weekend, there were threats. There was an evacuation at downtown police headquarters. It turns out that no suspect was apprehended and no weapons, I guess, were found. But I wonder if you sense a palpable climate of elevated alertness, of fear on the part of your fellow officers.
Well, absolutely. I mean, come on, we just had five people shot dead in the street.
And how do you cope with that?
We don't have a choice, and that's what the public doesn't understand. That next day, nobody didn't show up for work. That next day, we were mourning, we were crying, we were hurting, but what did we do? We got out of bed, we put on that vest, put on the blue uniform, strapped on our boots, and we went back out to serve the community. You didn't see us hate on them. You didn't see us say, hell no, we're not going back and serving the people that just murdered us. No, because 99.9% of the community out there wants us, needs us, and appreciates us. But those aren't the ones you hear. And that's what's killing the law enforcement community. I'm almost to the point, watch what you ask for, because we are making a profession that nobody wants to be a part of. This is going to be hard for me to say, but I'm going to tell the public this. I have a 12-year-old son, and I promise you this, if he ever asked me to that if he could be a cop, and I would tell him no.
Why?
I do not want him to have to go through what I see officers going through today. He doesn't deserve it.
Do you regret becoming a police officer yourself?
No. I don't regret becoming a police officer because in my 22 years, I have done a lot of good in this city. And if I die tomorrow, I can look at the face of Jesus Christ, and I promise I can look at him and be comfortable in saying, I left this world better than I came into it. I saved lives. Now, I don't know how the extent of that is, but I promise you, I made lives better. And 99.9% of the officers are going to face their maker and say the exact same thing. Are there ones that are going to go south? Absolutely. And do they need to? Absolutely. If we have officers that are violating rights and blatantly killing people, they need to be arrested and thrown in jail and rot. And most officers feel the exact same way because look what they're doing to the honest ones. But this broad paintbrush that we're painting our profession with has got to stop.
Let me ask you this. We have a short time left, about 30 seconds. Separate and apart from the police department, does the city of Dallas have a race problem?
I think every city. Well, let's be honest. Every person has something in them that is biased towards another person. Denial is what the problem is. Lack of communication is what the problem is. The citizens need to see what we're going through, and we in turn need to explain to the citizen what we do and why we do it. That's how you get rid of racism.
Sergeant Michael Mata is a 20-year veteran of the Dallas Police Department and is currently patrol sergeant at Northeast Division. He's also vice president of the Dallas Police Association. Sergeant Mata, thank you very much for making this time for us.
Thank you very much.
Up next, we will speak with the Reverend Richie Butler of St. Paul United Methodist Church, located in the Arts District at the edge of downtown Dallas, not too far from the scene of last Thursday's violence. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can find us on Twitter at KERAThink. From KERA in Dallas, you're listening to a special edition of Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Returning to our conversation about how Dallas is coping with the aftermath of Thursday's shooting of 12 police officers and two civilians, we've invited the Reverend Richie Butler of St. Paul United Methodist Church to join us. The church is located in the Arts District at the edge of downtown Dallas, a little over a mile from the site of the Thursday protest and shootings. Pastor Butler, thank you so much for joining us.
Glad to be with you today.
Did you have congregants in attendance Thursday night?
I did. Probably about a dozen of our congregants. Ironically, I was on vacation in Cancun, and we were getting tweets and Instagram communication from our members talking about how powerful the rally was and meaningful and the energy and the positive vibe that was taking place. And we went to dinner and come back from dinner, and basically all hell broke loose.
Yeah. So that must have been strange to think, oh, this thing has happened and it was peaceful and it accomplished what everybody wanted it to.
Yeah, and I think for some of the parishioners, we literally had a grief and crisis counselor come to the church on yesterday, because I think some of our parishioners actually saw law enforcement, you know, being killed. And mm-hmm. So I think that image and that pain and to go from such a high and a sense of hope to, you know, despair in a matter of seconds, it's daunting. And so, and I think our city definitely is in a state of shock.
Yeah.
And probably overwhelmed with a number of emotions, you know, sorrow, anger, frustration, question. I mean, you name it, you know, we're dealing with it. And I'm so grateful for many of my colleagues in the faith community, and I'm talking about cross, you know, denomination, even religious lines coming together and just thinking about how we attack this matter, because this is not a issue of analytics. This is an issue of heart and faith, And so we want to be responsive and help, you know, be part of leading our city to better days.
So many Christians believe in forgiveness as really a key tenet of their faith. It's very, very hard to find forgiveness in our hearts, either in situations where suspects appear to have been inappropriately killed by police. It is very hard to find forgiveness in our hearts for someone like Micah Johnson, who admitted to police that he committed these shootings and intended to do worse.
Yeah.
Do people who do these things deserve forgiveness?
As a pastor, yes. And I think... we all, and I guess to use a biblical reference, I mean, when Jesus was on the cross, there was a thief next to him whose life was, you know, committed to crime and doing wrong. And Jesus offered the kingdom to him. So I think all people have an opportunity and a right. But he sought forgiveness. And I think that also is another important point. But I think if we don't forgive, we allow people power over us that they don't deserve. What the young man did on Thursday night, he does not deserve the kind of power that we're giving him, the kind of airtime that he's been given in this manner. And we've got to rally around and to seek, I think, higher ground and a higher place and not allow ourselves to be mired in the muck.
You know that there are people who say every time we forgive, particularly in these situations that appear to be police abuse, we make it easier for it to happen again.
Well, I think part of, one, we have to clear our hearts and minds, and I think that's where forgiveness, but I think there's also accountability, and I think there is what many people are trying to push for, and that is a justice system that addresses those inconsistencies and those wrongs that have happened that you know in Minnesota wherever you know you just we go down the line, and we definitely need to address those. So forgiveness does not take away accountability, and I think we're called to hold each other accountable for our successes and also for our failures.
Why do our schools and our neighborhoods and our workplaces and our lives in this city remain effectively segregated in many areas when it's been decades since the law required that, but it still exists?
You know what? We are creatures of habit, and I guess the law of magnetism, we are attracted to those who are like us. And I think, on some measure, we have to be intentional and conscious about making a shift, a paradigm shift and change. And I think it starts probably with some of the places that are most sacred and important to us, like housing, where we live, and even where we worship. It is easy and it's very comfortable for us to go to, you know, our segregated neighborhoods and live in peace and not expose ourselves to others who may not look like us and even think like us. And therefore, I think we rob ourselves of the blessing of the diversity that I think our Creator provided for us as a community. And I think it's a clarion call for us as community of faith to respond. You know, for example, myself and Pastor Joe Clifford, the pastor of First Presbyterian Church, we did a pulpit swap on Palm Sunday. And literally our churches marched and met at Thanksgiving Square, and then I led his congregation back to his church, and he led our congregation back to our church. And you know, we need to do more of that. I had millennials at our church say, "We want to do more things that bring us together and not divide us." And I think what we don't realize when we aren't intentional about coming together, we are the unintentional consequences of that is that we stay divided.
What do you say to people who look at their own behaviors and their own attitudes and don't recognize any racial animosity? They think, I am not part of the problem, and therefore it might be somebody else, but I'm not part of the problem. What's the mechanism for assuming a kind of collective responsibility for a society in which conditions are not equal for everybody?
Yeah. you know, Howard Thurman, the great theologian, once said that we are called to center down and to turn inward. And I think part of our challenge is we have so much information, so much stuff that's coming at us. We are not very self-reflective, and we're not self-aware. And in many instances, we think that it's somebody else's problem. And I remind people all the time, it's not, quote unquote, the enemy, but the inner me that keeps us from being all that God has called us to be. And I think if we're honest with ourselves, and I appreciate the sergeant who was on here earlier, because he's right, we all bring biases to the table. And if we're not authentic and honest that we bring that bias, we cannot overcome or deal with it, because then we just cover up. And we know what happens when we continue to cover up. We get the tragedies and the issues that continue to perpetuate in our society.
Do you ever feel like the onus for fixing racism ends up falling to people of color?
I'll say this. We play a significant role, but I celebrate the fact that I have some white brothers and sisters who are walking along. For example, last year when the Baltimore riots took place, the day after that, I was praying to God. I said, what do I do in response to this? Well, God gave me, he said, why don't you get some clergy together and you guys pray for racial reconciliation? And so my first intuition was not to try to do this as Richie Butler, an African-American pastor. And so I called Andy Stoker, pastor of First United Methodist Church, and I said, I need you to come along with me. We're going to co-convene a prayer call with clergy. And I think, you know, we need to look to partner and team up on every opportunity to walk hand in hand, so it doesn't appear to be just a quote-unquote black matter issue, but it is a human issue. And I think when we realize that the only thing that separates us is or different from each other is the color of our skin, and realize that what we really do have in common is that we all bleed and our blood is the same color. And then what that suggests is that, you know what? Black folk are not just my people. White folk are my people. Asian folk are my people.
People are your people.
Yeah, people are my people. And I cannot, and when you think of people in that term, that they are my people, then we tend to see our people differently than we look at other people. And so when I recognize you are my people, something happens to you, it happens to me. If you're hurt, I should feel that hurt.
I love that you have this confidence that God is giving you good ideas that, you know, and orders, right, to execute things that will bring good to the community. Do you ever just wish God would whisper into the ear of people who are causing problems?
Well, you know what? It may take, and actually my goal is to work myself out of a job. But unfortunately, as Jesus said, the poor will be with you. And I believe also troublemakers will be with us, as just part of the human condition. But I wish God would whisper. But you know what? That's part of why he's called us to do what we do. And that is that we have to maybe not whisper. We sometimes have to scream and shout from the mountain to those in anticipation that they will hear. And in shouting, the people we didn't think we were going to reach, we just may reach. So our job is to you know, devise that clarion call and to continue to hold the mantle to encourage our community and our residents that better days are ahead. And through this tragic event that happened in Dallas, I believe Dallas is poised. We are leading. Think about this. We're leading the nation, you know, with job growth. We're leading the nation and so many areas of business. Now we have an opportunity to lead our nation in this area called racial reconciliation.
You are so relentlessly positive and optimistic. Do you go places in this city, your city, and feel like you are treated differently than a white pastor of the church across the street? Particularly a young, you know, as a young black man.
Yeah. I appreciate that. I'm not as young as I look. you know what? I realize that that exists, but I don't play to that. I also know life is not fair. And so my focus is, you know, sort of like David in the Bible was called to lead all of Israel, which was 12 tribes, but he was only assigned one tribe to begin with. And so I'm only focused on the little tribe, little area that, that God has given me and the responsibility I have at St. Paul and the work that I do in business. And so those are the things and I realize that there are going to be people because of my race, because of my age that you know, may not, you know, want to engage or interact. And so I don't want to allow them to deter what I'm called to do. And furthermore, to steal my joy. Again, I said earlier, when you allow people that kind of power of over your feelings, then they have control. And I don't want anyone but me and God to control my emotions and my enthusiasm and hope.
What do you say to people who are struggling to respond to the horrible events last week of shootings by police, of shootings of police, with compassion and understanding and optimism? People who at this point can't feel anything except sorrow and anger.
You know, this is not the first. It won't be the last time that we've had tragedy. But we have... In our own personal lives and even as a community, but we have overcome and we will, as the days move forward, we'll move past this. And I believe it is our responsibility as leaders, religious, community, political leaders, business, civic, to come together and to give people, to show people, to give people some signs, some signals of hope, and that out of this tragedy that started in Baton Rouge to Minnesota to Dallas, that out of this past week, that the not just the weeks but the years ahead, we will see good come out of it. I'll close with this. You know, I think in the Bible it says, you know, what in Genesis, what they meant for evil, God is going to turn to good. And I believe God is going to use this for our good, and we're going to be better people. We're going to have better families. And we're going to be a better community as a result of this tragedy.
The Reverend Richie Butler of St. Paul United Methodist Church in downtown Dallas. Pastor Butler, thank you so much for spending this time with us.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Samantha Guzman is associate producer with help on the phones today from Elizabeth Myong, and our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. Our Twitter handle is at KERA Think. Mine is at Chris Boyd Think, and you can email the show at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.